Good afternoon, this is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. It's now Wednesday, it's nice and warm, and some people don't like that at night, but in about a month's time, we're going to be missing nice days like this. So it's a bit warm today, a bit hot for some people, but so today is Wednesday, August 24th, and my show will play on August 25th. So there is news about another sunspot, and we can expect this because the solar cycle is at maximum now. It's going to be like that for a couple more years, so we're going to have sunspots, and some of them will be aimed at us. And here's an article here on LifeScience.com. So after I read this article, I'm going to talk about the Artemis program because it's exciting, and they don't seem to be falling behind there. They seem to want to make their initial target of 2024 for landing a woman on the moon. So we can look forward to that. So right now there is a sunspot. It's grown tenfold in the last 2 days. And it says here it's a planet-sized sunspot. So maybe it's as big as the Earth. And this article says it is aimed directly at Earth. And the region could send unexpected solar flares our way. So the name of the article, again, a planet size sunspot is aimed directly at Earth, and it's grown tenfold in the past few days. So I don't know if it was a 10 times the size of a planet a few days ago, or if it grew tenfold to be the size of a planet. So it's not saying exactly, it's kind of vague, but anyway, it's apparently aimed directly at us, and sometimes these things spin away from us and sometimes they'll spin towards us, but right now apparently it is aimed directly at planet Earth. So we can maybe in a few days expect some more auroras or things like that. So scientists have detected a rapidly growing sunspot that's pointed directly at Earth and could launch an assault of solar energy our way in the coming days. The sunspot, named AR3085, for the active region of the sun in which it appeared, was barely a blip several days ago. Now it has grown 10 times bigger, morphing into a pair of sunspots that each measure nearly the diameter of Earth. Oh, so then we know now. It was smaller before, after it grew tenfold than its size of Earth. This short GIF shows the spot's evolution over about 2 days. So if you want to see that GIF, you go to the article, a planet-sized sunspot grew tenfold in the last 2 days, and it's aimed directly at Earth. So it's dated Wednesday, August 20. Number of solar flares, large explosions of electromagnetic radiation that snap off from the sun's surface and launch outward into space have been detected crackling around the spot, according to Space Weather. Fortunately, they are all currently C-class flares, which fit into the weakest of the three tiers of solar flare that government satellites track. A, B, and C-class flares are generally too weak to have a noticeable impact on Earth. So it's strange that they get you enticed by, in the title they say, a giant solar flare is aimed directly at us. It's grown tenfold in the past few days, and then now it says it's going to be too weak to have a noticeable impact on Earth. So they got me all excited, and now they are letting me down. So M-class flares are stronger, capable of causing radio blackouts at high altitudes, while X-class flares are the strongest and can cause widespread radio blackouts, damage satellites, and knock out ground-based power grids, according to NASA. So what I do remember, a few years ago, there was a powerful solar storm headed our way. So the astronauts inside the space shuttle went to hide in a place on the space shuttle that would protect them from any solar radiation. So it can be dangerous for satellites or astronauts outside. Scientists have or outside of Earth's atmosphere. Scientists have detected a rapidly growing sunspot that points directly at Earth and could launch an assault of solar energy our way in the coming days. If the spots continue to grow over the coming days, they could produce strong flares that could barrel towards Earth, potentially endangering satellites and communication systems. For now, however, there is no imminent danger. Sunspots are large dark regions of strong magnetic fields that form on the sun's surface. These regions would typically measure as wide as planets, appear darker because they are cooler than their surroundings. They form where bands of the sun's magnetic field become tangled and taut, inhibiting the flow of hot gas from the sun's interior and forming cooler, darker regions on the sun's surface. These pileups of magnetic energy often lead to solar flares. The more sunspots that appear on the sun at a given time, the more likely solar flares are to erupt. The prevalence of both sunspots and solar flares are linked to the sun's 11-year cycle of activity, which transitions between periods of high and low sunspots density every decade or so. The next solar maximum, or the period of highest sunspot activity, is predicted to hit in 2025, with as many as 115 sunspots likely to appear on the sun's surface during its days of peak activity. Solar activity has been ramping up over the last few years, with numerous X-class flares swooping over our planet since spring 2022, sometimes within days of one another. The number of sunspots and solar flares will likely increase as time ticks towards the next solar maximum. And here is a good video. Let's see if I can play it. It says predicting sunspots with techniques borrowed from earthquake analysis.
Scientists are learning to predict sunspots before they can actually be seen. That's important because these dark stains on the sun's surface can herald scary solar flares and huge coronal mass ejections, which sometimes fry sensitive satellites in Earth orbit and cause power outages on the ground. Such storms are born deep inside the sun, results of titanic magnetic forces at work there. These turbulent bubbles boil up to the surface of our star, where astronomers have been watching them for more than 400 years. But just recently, astrophysicists, using techniques similar to those used for earthquake monitoring, have deduced that subtle vibrations rippling across the visible facade of the sun are correlated to disturbances far below. It's a technique they call helioseismology. In basic terms, sound waves travel faster across a submerged sunspot-forming region than they do through the surrounding area. The acoustic energy signature may appear more than 15 seconds earlier if it's been ringing across a particularly big storm. That can give officials in charge of communications networks or power grids as much as 2 days' notice before a sunspot finally percolates up. That's plenty of time to know if the sunspot will be aimed at Earth. The trick now is to figure out which sunspots will produce flares and mass ejections, and exactly when they'll fire. But scientists don't know how to do that trick just yet.
Okay, so that was a nice video about sunspots, and I didn't mention this earlier, but the article, it's by somebody called Brandon Spector, and I've seen his name quite a bit on this website on Live Science. So what I wanted to also talk about was not just our sun, but the Artemis program.
The whole turning people to stone thing killed Medusa's social life. So she ordered sunglasses with Prime one day delivery.
So the Artemis program to me is exciting because we're going back to the moon. I say we, like Canada's going back to the moon, and astronauts have gone back to the moon, are into space on the International Space Station with NASA rockets, and it's a NASA program. I'm sure there'll be some presence for the Canadians up there, but for now we're looking at a US-led project and US-led program. So if Canada does participate, I don't know how they will participate, but very often the U.S. lets Canada come into it. So to me, that's very exciting, and I mentioned it to I met a young lady on the bus the other day, and we were talking about NASA, because you know why? She had a NASA shirt. So she told me certain things she likes about astronomy, and I mentioned to her about the Artemis program, how a woman will step on the moon in a few years, and she said, I'm all for that. So I think a lot of people are for that. So remember, we're going to talk about the Artemis program, but I think with NASA's great planning and foresight, there it's apparently the moon in itself will yield results, but it's, I think, a dress rehearsal, what I've read here, a dress rehearsal for going to Mars. But let's not forget there's hundreds of programs going on in the International Space Station in microgravity, testing all kinds of things to do with microgravity. And they are the low Earth orbit economy, LEO. That's going to be a big thing in the future. So there's lots of activity going on in space. So I think they're going to be doing a lot of things on the moon other than just saying, oh, we're going to walk on the moon. There's probably going to be habitation there and all kinds of experiments. So now the Artemis Mega Moon Rocket. Oh, first let me talk about the title. So the title of this article is Artemis Program, NASA's plan to send humans back to the moon. It's by Adam Mann, published about 17 hours ago. So now it's late Wednesday, almost Thursday. So I guess it's published on Wednesday the 24th. The subtitle is Basic Information About the Artemis Program, Space Launch System, and Orion Capsule. And one thing I did think about the Orion Capsule, it's been a few years now since it was finalized and tested, and that's going to be their rocket of choice when they go to the moon or when they go to Mars. And that could be, going to Mars could be 20 years in the future, but I'm thinking, why not develop a more advanced rocket? And I looked to last week's article when I talked about the Voyagers. So the two Voyager spacecraft reached their 45th birthday, and when it was talking about the Voyagers were launched in 1977, and of course that technology now 45 years later is so much more advanced than that. So I think they said something like your cell phone has 30,000 times more computing power or more energy or something like that than the Voyager spacecraft had. So imagine in 20 years how advanced things are going to be. They should get another capsule. That's just a thought anyway. So here it goes. The article is called Artemis Program, NASA's Plan to Send Humans Back to the Moon. It's on Life Science. And here goes. The Artemis Mega Moon Rocket is NASA's latest and most powerful launch vehicle, intended to return astronauts, robots, and supplies to the moon for the first time in more than 50 years. Consists of a multi-stage rocket called the Space Launch System, SLS, which can carry various additional modules atop it, such as the Orion crew vehicle that houses astronauts during flight. The SLS is an outgrowth of a previously planned rocket called ARESV, or ARES-5, a heavy-lift, two-stage, vertically stacked launch system capable of carrying about 287,000 pounds, or 130,000 kilograms, to low Earth orbit, or 143,000 pounds, 65,000 kilograms, to the moon. ARES-V was part of the Constellation program, an initiative started during the George W. Bush administration that intended to return people to the moon. Constellation was deemed too expensive, but in 2010, President Barack Obama signed the NASA Authorization Act of 2010 into law, directing NASA to create an ARES-5-like rocket called the Space Launch System. Although the SLS is intended for use in crewed missions, the Artemis mission to send humans beyond low Earth orbit for the first time since 1972 has suffered numerous delays. I didn't know that. I thought it was on schedule. But anyway, here goes. So I remember when President Trump announced the Artemis program, he talked like it was his initiative, but I guess it says here it was instituted by Obama. And many years ago when Carter was the president, President Carter, he announced the B-1 bomber, but it was already in the works for many years. So sometimes presidents take credit for these things when they were already started before their administration. SLS is a super heavy lift launch vehicle capable of taking astronauts to destinations all over the solar system, including the Moon and Mars. It can be organized into several evolvable and increasingly powerful configurations, allowing the agency, NASA, to take on even more ambitious missions. The rocket consists of a core stage towering more than 212 feet or 65 meters, with a diameter of 27.6 feet or 8 meters. When capped by the Orion crew capsule, the core stage will stand 322 feet or 98 meters tall, higher than the Statue of Liberty, and weigh 5.75 million pounds or 2.6 million kilograms. Along with two solid rocket boosters strapped to its side, the SLS can reach speeds of 24,500 miles per hour or 40,000 kilometers per hour, fast enough to escape Earth's gravity and reach the Moon or beyond. The core stage is powered by four RS-25 engines originally used to launch the space shuttle. These engines utilize liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, and with the additional solid fuel rocket boosters, provide 8.8 million pounds of thrust, surpassing the space shuttle system of 7.8 million pounds. And that's according to the Houston Space Center. Under its initial Block 1 configuration, I'm going to stop here for a sec because I got to go back to that. In 1987, I went to the Houston Space Flight Center because I went to Houston. And I went inside, and it was free to go inside. There was no security measures. There were a lot of rockets outside. And, of course, they were previously used rockets. And I posed for a lot of pictures. And there was tours all over the place. And one tour in particular, we paid $5 for, and it took us on a nice tour. There was another one where they had a kind of like Disneyland or kind of ride where you could go inside and you could pretend like you were, and it would bounce you around like you were in outer space in a rocket or in a vehicle. So times have sure changed, haven't they? Now there's probably lots of security and it costs a lot of money to get inside. Under its initial Block 1 configuration, the SLS can ferry 59,500 pounds to the Moon. The next configuration, Block 1B crew, will add a powerful exploration upper stage that will provide an additional 97,000 pounds of thrust to the rocket and make it taller than the Saturn V rocket that carried Apollo astronauts to the Moon. Block 1B crew can send 83,700 pounds to deep space, allowing researchers to bring supplies and experiment to Mars or beyond. And that just brings up a point here, which I've talked about before, and especially Elon Musk. Musk keeps saying that to go to Mars, you need reusable rockets. And it's true, because if you go to Mars, you got to somehow come back. And they're not going to build a rocket on Mars, so you got to have a reusable rocket. The most advanced currently planned configuration, called Block 2, will provide 9.5 million pounds of thrust, and we will be able to lift more than 101,400 pounds to deep space. NASA intends the Block 2 configuration of the SLS, which will stand 365 feet or 111 meters high, to be the workhorse for missions all over the solar system. Now that sounds promising, doesn't it? And here there's a photo of something. What is it? NASA's Orion spacecraft, a critical part of the agency's Artemis 1 mission, is nearing the end of a three-month testing campaign. I thought they finished their testing at the agency's Plum Brook station in Sandusky, Ohio. During the testing, the craft was subjected to the extreme temperatures and electromagnetic environment it will experience in its upcoming test mission to the moon. So here's a beautiful picture of Orion. Wow, it looks so nice. The Orion spacecraft carries crew, life support, and power for up to 4 astronauts, according to NASA. The crew module is 11 feet high with a diameter of 16.5 feet, giving it 316 cubic feet of interior space, much more than 3 Apollo astronauts had during their trips to the moon, according to Life Sciences' sister site space.com. So when we think of that, I was under the impression it's a mission to Mars. How many crew members can go? Because to think of it is 6 months to get to Mars, 6 months to come back, and then when the launch window is open to launch to Mars, that means Earth and Mars are at their closest, and then Earth and Mars move relative to each other in about a year, let's say. Could be a bit more, but Earth and Mars will be, after that, Earth and Mars will be at the opposite sides of the Sun. So it will take another 10 months or 12 months to get them close again, and then there's a 6-month trip back. So there is, looks like it's about a 26-month or 30-month mission to go to Mars, because they couldn't launch when Earth and Mars are at the opposite sides of the Sun. So they have to launch when the launch window comes up, when they're closest. So you think there's going to be lots of months they're going to be up there, maybe a couple of years. And then if there's four crew members, these crew members, like all NASA missions, they're very highly trained. But then, for example, everybody could guess this. You're going to need a doctor on board. So, for example, the doctor could have another specialty, because there's lots of things to take care of when you're in outer space for 26 months and no one's with you. So there'd have to maybe overlap the specialties of the astronauts. So you have to think, are they going to send 2 women and 2 men? One of them's going to be a doctor with other skills, so that doctor has to be an astronaut. And then these other crew members have other special skills. So that's going to be intriguing, or interesting at least, to see who are the crew members that are going to go up there and what kind of skills they will all have. Because as we know, they have to think of a lot of things. And of course, most likely has to be a doctor. Okay, so this article is a bit longer. So what I'm going to do is take a break. When I come back, we're going to talk more about the Artemis moon mission on CITR 101.9.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You listen to the Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. And when I said Artemis moon mission, I meant Artemis launch system, or Artemis 1 program with the SLS launch system. So I was talking about what kind of specialties the 4 astronauts will have. I thought there's going to be a lot more astronauts, but I guess it makes sense. You can't send 8 or 10 astronauts up into space. And what's going to happen when choosing them? You have to choose astronauts with mixed skills, and they have to be specialized in these skills. So it's going to be very cool to see how they choose those astronauts. But anyway, the crew module is 11 feet with a diameter of 16.5 feet, giving it a 316 cubic feet or 9 cubic meters of interior space. Not very much, much more than three Apollo astronauts had during their trips to the moon. But of course, on their trips to the moon, the Apollo astronauts had not a very long trip to the moon, stayed there a bit, and then came back. So I think they're back within 10 days. And as I was speculating or just thinking, there's going to be maybe a two-year mission to Mars. But anyway, the vehicle is made mainly from aluminum alloys with an outer layer of 1300 thermal protection silica tiles, similar to the ones used on the underside of the space shuttle. The bottom of the capsule carries a large heat shield to protect crews as they re-enter Earth's atmosphere, when Orion will be traveling a screaming 25,000 miles per hour or 40,000 kilometers per hour and reach temperatures as high as 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit or 2,760 degrees Celsius, more than half as hot as the surface of the Sun. The Orion capsule contains four adjustable seats, dispensers to provide drinking water, a microwave to reheat food, exercise devices to keep the crew fit during missions, air filters, and a compact toilet. In the event of a blast of dangerous solar radiation, astronauts will be able to take shelter in two large lockers at the floor of the capsule. Wow. Just like now, where astronauts take shelter in the International Space Station when a blast of radiation comes their way. And here's an illustration. It shows illustration of Artemis astronauts on the moon, image credit NASA. But what's missing here, I think, is going to be when Artemis astronauts are on the moon, there's going to be a shelter underneath, and there's probably going to be robots everywhere. And as I talked about, Boston Dynamics is creating certain robots that are already used in industry. And that article I read about the robots is the only thing that's stopping from the robots from being used in everyday life is the cost. They just cost too much. So the robots they use in, let's say, factories to do work, they can do much more work than people could do, and they could work 16 hours straight. And so it's going to be cool to see robots up there. SLS and Orion are part of NASA's Artemis program, which intends to bring the first woman and the first person of color to the moon by 2026. I thought it was 2024. Okay, so now they've changed again. And eventually establish a permanent crewed presence on Earth. Well, as I was saying, I'm excited about Artemis, but now they've changed the date to 2026. I thought it was 2024, because that's what Trump said. Anyway, in June 2022, NASA conducted a wet dress rehearsal at SLS, in which engineers filled it with fuel and performed a mock countdown. The rehearsal was canceled with just 29 seconds left on the countdown clock due to a hydrogen leak, but officials said they nonetheless got a great deal of useful information from the test. So imagine if something like this happens. Let's say astronauts are, whenever it's going to happen, 20 years from now, maybe more, but let's say if astronauts actually go to Mars, and what's going to happen when, let's say, a fuel leak happens up there. Well, they'll be so far away from the Earth, it's not like Apollo 13, where they were just a few days away and they could talk with mission control and get it settled. So I guess a lot of people will be biting their fingernails and thinking about, what's going to happen if something happens up there. So what's going to happen if something happens? The Artemis II mission, currently scheduled for 2024, will take astronauts around the moon, but not land them there. If that mission is successful, NASA hopes to land people on the moon with the Artemis III mission. Okay, so here it says about additional resources. It says, learn all about the Artemis program from NASA's official Artemis website, and the agency's SLS page will keep you up to date on events and missions involving the rocket. You can also watch a video about the various components of the Orion module in this YouTube video. So I'm playing a video about the Orion capsule and all its components, and there's no sound, so I'm sorry about that. I tried, but I thought, now that would be so interesting to listen to the components of the, because whenever, for example, I open something and it talks about the Webb telescope and it shows its certain components, its electronics, its cams, it's just so fascinating. So here I am not able to play this program, which I am sorry about, because I wanted about this Orion spacecraft. And I think I'm really surprised that there's going to be, the Orion capsule can only carry four people, and you think it's so small, the four people got to be there for a long time. Wow, that's going to be a tough thing to do. Okay, so here's an article which is in the news. I guess in a way it's in the news, but it's about the war in Ukraine, and it says, nuclear winter from a U.S.-Russia conflict would wipe out 63% of the world's population. It's published 6 days ago, which is the 19th of August. So there goes, the war could reduce global calorie production by 90%. Ooh. Okay. More than 5 billion people, roughly 63% of the world's current population, would die of famine in the aftermath of a full-scale nuclear war between the United States, Russia, and their allies, a new study has revealed. According to the researchers, the conflict would create widespread fires that could eject up to 165 million tons of soot into the Earth's atmosphere, leading to crop declines in the food-exporting U.S. and Russia that would send global calorie production plummeting by as much as 90%. The study, published August 15th in the journal Nature Food, is the latest in four decades of landmark research that has attempted to sketch out the threat of a nuclear war. Of the world's approximately 12,705 nuclear warheads, Russia has 5,977 and the United States has 5,428, according to Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's latest report. The country with the third most nuclear warheads, China with 350, India and Pakistan have 160, 165 respectively. So China only has, it says, 350. Wow. A full-scale nuclear war would produce climate change that is unprecedented in human history. Study co-author Alan Robcock, a professor of climate science at Rutgers University in New Jersey, said at a news conference on Monday, August 15th, in a U.S.-Russian nuclear war, more people would die from famine in India and Pakistan alone than in the countries actually fighting the war. The most immediate effects of any nuclear war, at least for those in a targeted city, have been popularly known since the dropping of the U.S. atomic bomb, Little Boy, on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. The single bomb killed an estimated 140,000 people within 5 months of its detonation and destroyed or severely damaged more than 60,000 of the city's approximately 90,000 buildings. Six eyewitness accounts compiled by the journalist John Hersey and published in 1946 tell of the attack's instantaneous devastation and its immediate aftermath. First, the light of the bomb appeared as a blinding, noiseless flash as bright as the sun. Then the shockwave arrived, hurling bodies under toppling buildings. In the aftermath, the clear black shadows of the vaporized dead were seen stenciled on the walls and streets, and the survivors who were closely exposed to the blast emerged naked, their skin sloughed off by the heat of the explosion, to wander the ruined city in stunned bewilderment. Studies sprung up as soon as 1947 to document the suffering following the attack, which for many would last a lifetime. Radioactive fallout, a byproduct of the nuclear fission reaction that gave Little Boy its cataclysmic power. I think the other one on Nagasaki was called Fat Man, had blanketed the area. In Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which was bombed 3 days later, increased rates of cancer, cataracts, and other health conditions persisted for years in survivors who had been close to the bomb's epicenter. but it would take more than four decades for scientists to begin to learn and discuss the most lethal and frightening outcome of even a small-scale nuclear war, so-called nuclear winter. In this doomsday scenario, radioactive dust and smoke would block out a significant portion of the sun's light. With temperatures dropping, many of the world's crops, smothered by the gloom, would die, creating a global famine and wiping out billions of people. To model how this apocalyptic event would affect the planet's ability to sustain life, the researchers calculated the amount of soot that would be generated from six potential nuclear war scenarios, ranging from five scenarios based on a limited war between India and Pakistan over the Kashmir region, which would produce 5.5 million to 52 million tons of soot, dependent on the conflict scale, to full-scale global nuclear war involving the U.S. and Russia, which would produce countless conflagrations veiling the sky with 165 million tons of soot. With the soot quantities in hand, the scientists plugged the data into the National Center for Atmospheric Research, NCAR, or NCAR, Community Earth System Model, a forecasting tool that simulates changes to Earth's sunlight, temperature, and precipitation. These changes were then fed into NCAR's Community Land Model, which gave the scientists a country-by-country breakdown of the dramatic reductions a nuclear winter would bring to corn, rice, soybean, wheat, and fish harvests. Assuming that international trade stopped and that the remaining resources weren't hoarded, the scientists subsequently calculated how nuclear winter would reduce the food calories produced worldwide, as well as the number of people who would starve as a consequence. The researchers found that in the worst-case scenario of a nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, temperatures on Earth's surface would drop by as much as 29 degrees Fahrenheit or 16 degrees Celsius, or more than three times the temperature difference between now and the last ice age, and that 5 billion people would perish. In the most extreme war between India and Pakistan, global calorie production could drop by 50%, causing 2 billion deaths. And we don't have to think of a nuclear war as just the only doomsday scenario. Let's say a big solar flare, a big solar storm hit Earth, and then all of a sudden the electronics were wiped out for months. And, for example, I live on the 11th floor. Probably could get up and down my elevator, and water or electricity wouldn't be pumped to my apartment. And then I'd have to walk down 11 stories to get to the bottom floor. And then there would be no food in the grocery stores. How could anybody survive with that? And toilets would plug up, and just crazy, these doomsday scenarios. The hardest hit regions would be food importing countries in Africa and the Middle East, according to the scientists. Australia and New Zealand, meanwhile, would fare the best, because they would avoid most of the bombs dropped in the Northern Hemisphere and rely on wheat crops that could grow better in the cooler climate. And here's another related article. How deadly is Putin's nuclear Satan II missile? Never heard of that. So says study co-author Owen B. Toon, a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics, who worked with Carl Sagan on a 1983 paper credited with introducing the concept of nuclear winter. And here's the quote. The important thing to know is the amount of smoke being put into the atmosphere. The energy released from these fires is 100 to 1,000 times the energy released by the weapons themselves. It doesn't rain in the stratosphere, so when that much smoke gets up there, it will stay there for years, end quote. Toon, Sagan, and their collaborators were first drawn to the topic of nuclear winter after taking note of a surprising revelation about what might have killed the dinosaurs. In 1980, a separate team of scientists discovered that an asteroid had struck Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula at the end of the Cretaceous period about 65 million years ago. As is common knowledge today, the astronauts wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs, but it wasn't the energy from the collision that killed around 75% of Earth's animals, including the dinos. It was the cooling cloud of dust and debris that the impact released. And I do remember in one article I read, there were quite a few super volcanoes a year or two before that, so there was already a lot of soot and dust in the atmosphere. Using rudimentary atmospheric models and satellite data, Toon, Sagan, and their colleagues applied their insight to nuclear conflicts. They found that small-scale thermonuclear wars, using as few as 100 one-megaton nuclear warheads, could start enough fires to send a thick layer of jet-black smoke into the atmosphere, causing land temperatures around much of the world to plummet 5 to minus 13 degrees Fahrenheit within just one or two weeks. They forecasted a cooling effect that would last up to 2 decades. The possibility of extinction of Homo sapiens cannot be excluded, their study concluded. Wow. Sagan had been drawn to the questions of humanity's long-term survival through his interest in the Drake equation, the famous formula that enables scientists to guess the potential number of intelligent alien civilizations living in the Milky Way. Concerningly, the first estimate made by the inventor of the equation, the astrophysicist Frank Drake, suggested that the advanced extraterrestrial civilizations occupying our galaxy could number anywhere between 20 to 50 million. This made Sagan ponder an idea as the Fermi paradox. If that were the case, why haven't we encountered them yet? He concluded that intelligent civilizations must not last very long because they were destroying themselves with nuclear weapons or other kind of weapons. While the overall quantity of the Earth's nukes has dropped sharply since the end of the Cold War, the number of countries that possess the weapons has increased, and bilateral peace treaties between the U.S. and Russia, discarded by Russian President Vladimir Putin and then U.S. President Donald Trump, are unlikely to be renewed during Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine. China, meanwhile, could be planning to quadruple its nuclear arsenal to more than 1,000 by the end of the decade. All of the nuclear-armed states are increasing or upgrading their arsenals, and most are sharpening nuclear rhetoric and the role nuclear weapons play in their military strategies. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute wrote in its latest annual report, which put global annual military spending at a record high of $2.1 trillion for 2021, its seventh consecutive year of increase. The new research highlights the need to commit to long-term disarmament strategies that will eradicate nuclear weapons from the planet. If nuclear weapons exist, they can be used, and the world has come close to nuclear war several times. Banning nuclear weapons is the only long-term solution. The 5-year-old UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which bans the development, testing, production, stockpiling, stationing, transfer, use, and the threat of nuclear weapons, has been ratified by 66 nations, but none of the 9 nuclear states. Our work makes clear that it is time for those 9 states to listen to science and the rest of the world and sign this treaty. Well, what would happen if there were no nuclear weapons and then Russia started the war in Ukraine? Well, there could be an easier path to war because they're not fearful of nuclear weapons. And I doubt all countries would not hide some nuclear weapons. In addition, the current nuclear arms reduction treaty called New START is set to expire in 2026. In addition to taking weapons off alert and committing to second use on both sides, should work to reduce the excessive arsenals by negotiating a new treaty to replace the New START treaty. A key test of these political barriers is this month's 10th Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. Delegates are currently gathering at the UN headquarters in New York to renew and expand pledges on nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament. So far, however, little progress has been made at the conference. Okay, so I'm going to go for a break now. When I come back, talk more science, more astronomy on CITR 101.9.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Do you hear what I'm hearing?
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost.
I'm just living my dream.
Check us out online at ubc-voc.com.
For everybody who should live it, go and get it, you should live it.
Okay, welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroShock on CITR 101.9 here on NASA.gov. And there's one article that says, Artemis 1, join our virtual NASA social to explore the launch of the Artemis 1 mission. And the next article is NASA history. NASA, Rice University, marks 60th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's speech, where he said, we will go to the moon. Not because it's easy, but because it's hard, the way his accent was. Okay. Now, here's an interesting thing, because I know I'm just wondering what they're going to do on the moon. But here's an article that says, three companies to help NASA advance solar array technology for the moon. So you just know when they get to the moon, they're going to be doing a lot of things up there. So that is going to be an interesting thing.